Very small interest, and it's the biggest struggle. Yeah. It stays with us for our lifetimes. It's just such an interesting thing to me, but that's all right. All right, so tonight, again, this will just be a little, I figured just an informal discussion. So the topic that I wanted to cover tonight in the book, in Faber Maslisch's book, she breaks it up into two separate chapters, one on comparisons and one on roles. But it's really, I found, to be almost one and all of the same, so we'll just sort of talk about it like that. So I'll just throw out a couple of phrases. These are the kinds of things that we say and that we hear. Things like, she's my artistic one. Mm-hmm. He's handy around the house. Very common things. That's more in the role. Sometimes when we have in the comparison example, we have more things along the lines of, and I have found this less in my own experience, both in terms of my own house and when I constantly have others at my house or I'm at others' houses, and so I hear these less, the kind of things like, you would never see Michael eating with his fingers. Mm-hmm. I don't hear that as much, that kind of comparison, but comparisons are inevitable in a family. It just sort of happens. She's always so nicely put together. So sometimes where I see the roles and the comparisons blending is in which you might not overtly be referring to two children at the same time, but in the way that we address one, it comes out inevitably that on some level or another, the other one is being addressed. This one is fearless. This one is afraid of their own shadow. Those kinds of things we hear literally all the time in which the roles are established. Chaim, he's my future accountant. Sarah over here, or Shimon, she's going to be our lawyer. This is the leader, this is the popular one in the family. We say things like that in which we define the roles of, this one's going to be a good accountant, this one's good in math. And the question is, why do we do that? And this is really where the discussion comes in, because it's important to hear where we're coming from, because we do that. We say, this one's going to be the accountant, this one's going to be the lawyer in the family. And we started at a very young age, and the question is really, where are we coming from as parents when we see that in our children and we say those things?
I was thinking sometimes it could be encouraging to a child
to hear that. And I want to bolster their ego. In other words, you see a child who's in fact handy around the house. So you'll say something like, this one is handy around the house. And, I mean, that, it sort of makes sense in that, from that perspective, where we're coming from, in the sense of trying to bolster their ego. Now, sometimes that comes at a sibling's expense, and if you'll say in the sense of, this is my responsible one. As if you're just being handy, okay, so I'm not handy, it's not such an insult to me. But when you say it in the sense of, this one's the responsible one, then it becomes a very different story. That becomes really, it's a put down to everybody else in order to bolster this one's ego. Why else do we do things like that?
Well, it makes us feel good, too.
You guys are like going exactly in order that I have here.
Like, we've done a good job. Like, he's right? Going to be a great
right?
one,
it's she's a big, exactly, right? It's a big ego boost for us that we're able to say, lawyer, doctor, rabbi.
Right.
Perfect. I mean, you got it all. What Jewish... you can't do any better than that. Or doctor, doctor, doctor. I mean, that's like really something. Lawyer, doctor. I mean, leave aside of our So we do that sometimes for ourselves in the sense of we feel the need to define them in the sense of feeling good about them. What else? I'm just saying I have like four things here. So far you've got them in order. So number three would be, I would say it a little differently in the sense of to say that we have them figured out. Mm-hmm. In other words, we as parents have this little baby that comes in, and as a baby we don't try yet, but then the baby gets a little bit older, and by the time they're hitting threes, fours, fives, sixes for sure, personalities have developed, they're people. And we like to think, oh, you got them. I know my child. Because I don't know if it's even subconscious in the sense of, like, what would be if a person would say, like, what's your child like? And you would say, I have no idea what they're like. Well, that's an indictment as a parent. And you have no idea what they're like. So almost subconsciously, and sometimes more consciously, we want to know what they're like. And that's really not coming from a bad place at all. I think one of the In the other workshop that I've done, just in the general parenting workshop, one of the examples that I give in the very beginning is parenting is like getting a seed. You have this seed, and it's planted. Hamish, come around the table. It's not a marriage workshop, so you can split up if you want. It's like getting a seed, and it's put in a little cup, like your kid comes home from school, except you have no idea what kind of seed it is in parenting. And it's not labeled tomato plant versus apple tree. So how do you help it grow? So our job is really to provide the environment, figure out how much sunlight, how much water, how many times a week does it need to be fertilized, and then what kind of temperature does it need, and make it grow to its best possible thing. But you're given no instructions as to what kind of seed you have. So we actually very consciously work on figuring out what this is so that we'll know how to handle it. Is this going to be the kind of child that needs this or that? And if we don't have any idea, so we label the artistic one, because we think if I know my child is artistic versus a mathematician, I'll know what kind of education to give, I'll know what kind of... So it's coming from a very good place, except that we sometimes take it a little bit too far and that we think we've pegged them into their little hole. But I would say there's the most important one, the fourth one on the list is probably the most important one. We're asking the question as to why is that we define roles. We'll say things like, you know, this is my artistic one, this is my aggressive one, this is my peace-loving one, this is the fragile. We do things like that. And the most important reason?
Well, I don't know if it's the most important, but sometimes children really demonstrate certain proclivities, you know.
Yes, okay, well, again, and we're well-placed, we're not making things up. They are showing to be better at math, more adept at art, whatever it may be. But why do we have the need to point it out and define them that way? This is probably the most fundamental reason.
That children are a reflection of us and...
Could be.
Because it's easier.
Okay, we started touching a little bit easier. We want to peg them. I would say the most important reason is because we want to make them feel special. Here I have 2, 3, 4 children in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I, as a parent, am constantly struggling to help them identify themselves, become who they are. So again, coming from a good place, I will make every effort to say... This one, now again, I'm not even talking about the times when we do it in a negative way, which you'll sometimes hear parents do. This one is, you know, they'll say this in front of the kids. I've heard parents say in front of, this is my wild child. This one is clumsy. This one is lazy. This one is forgetful. So I'm not even talking, like, I'm not even going there, where we define with negative attributes in front of the kids, where they hear us say, they're negative. I'm not even talking about that. That's like doesn't need to be said in terms of how destructive that is. Where a child hears their parents put them in a role that's negative.
Rabbi, I remember as a small child, something like that being said about. I've never forgotten. I can peg the moment like it happened yesterday.
There's no question when you hear someone like, and I've heard it. I've heard parents, and they're just sort of talking. They're schmoozing with adults, and kids listen to everything. They are sponges. And it's as if the kid isn't 3 feet away, playing on the floor, and on those, this is my aggressive one, this is forgetful, lazy, just, I'm not even talking about that. But even in a positive way, this is my lawyer, this is my accountant. This one is going to be the artist in the family. Kind of like sort of giving them, now again, we started with, you know, bolstering their ego, but we really want to give them a sense of who they are. So we very much do that. So not only do we put kids in roles, but you'd be surprised to note that kids often put themselves in roles. They play certain roles. As kids get a little bit older and a little bit smarter, they learn how the system works. They learn if they're the good kid that comes with certain privileges, and being the bad kid comes with certain privileges. Start getting away with certain things. If you're the clown in the family and you identify yourself and establish that role, you'll get away with saying things or doing things that nobody else does. If you identify yourself as the helpless one, kids will quickly learn that they can get away with doing less because they're the needy one. So aside from the fact that we identify them, they sometimes identify themselves, and then other kids in the family identify other kids as the ones who need certain things. So this is just setting up that if you'll pay attention to the concept of these roles that they're put into, or these comparisons, it comes from a lot of different places, in the sense that we do it, they do it, they do it to themselves. And the real issue becomes that what happens to a child once that role is established? Let's say for the child who the role happens to. What happens for the child who's established as the accountant, the one who's on time, or the one who's neat?
Pressure.
A tremendous amount of pressure. Now, we often don't think of it as pressure. This is the same sort of, we discussed this in some of the other workshops also, in terms of how we compliment. Sometimes when you compliment, you say to somebody, they show up in shul and you say, oh my goodness, you always look so put together. I'm so envious of you. I feel like such a shlump coming in Shabbos morning and go so hard with the kids. I look at you, oh, you look beautiful. So you think we're doing such a nice thing, right? Mm-hmm. Except what might be going on now internally come next Shabbos morning for this poor young woman who's got three kids and now is trying to get to shul. You got a tremendous amount of pressure of
looking beautiful.
Yeah. I know my wife suffers from this when people will make a big deal about her cooking. And then she's having a simple dinner meeting, or someone's coming over, and there's this need to go all out because the person made such a big deal last time they were there, and they made such a big deal over the phone when they were excited when the plans are made. That's not a compliment anymore. It's a tremendous responsibility now. It's a tremendous pressure. So there's a way in which we compliment, in which we sometimes raise expectations which are unfair. So sometimes, now for the kid who's been placed in this role, has a tremendous amount of pressure. If you read through the book, she's got story after story after story of grown-ups bemoaning the fact that their whole life they felt, you know, they always have to be good. They always have to be neat. They always have to be on time. They couldn't be a kid who wanted to do things like kids do because the family had identified them as that role, and it became where they were sort of etched into that as far as that goes. A lot of self-fulfilling prophecies, especially on the negative side, when we say that kids are messy. Where's the drive for a child to work on being neat when they've been defined as messy? They've been put into that role as the messy child. I don't have any need or desire to try to be neat because I am messy. And if you're going to call me messy or lazy or stupid, so I might as well be messy or lazy or stupid, because it's a whole lot easier than working on the alternative. And what about the other children who are not in that role? What about the one who's not placed in the role? You know, this one is going to be the neat one. So what happens to everybody else?
They can stay as messy as
right?
they want.
I mean, this is obvious stuff I just want to start with as far they don't have to deal with it anymore, because that child is the one who always gives the Dvar Torah to Shabbos table. So I don't need to deal with that, because that one is always the child that's going to do it. And what often happens is that they're forced into the opposite role of whatever the one child does. One of the major drawbacks in this is a classic example that's brought in a lot of different stories is with piano playing. Right, lots of kids are given an instrument. Play the piano, fine. So you give lessons, you have a couple of kids. So the older one starts playing, and we can go either way with it. Either is poor, or is very talented right away and picks it up. It doesn't make a difference whichever way it is. Let's take the example, you're very good. The younger one starts lessons and it's not going. So if it becomes a thing where the parents can say, or are heard saying, so-and-so is really good at the piano, so the younger one, who might be enjoying playing the piano poorly, but actually likes it, but becomes, oh, that's their thing, and they'll go do something else. And again, I reference the book, these like gut-wrenching stories of adults mourning that they never had a chance to do gymnastics or piano or athletics because they had an older or sometimes a younger sibling. A lot of times what happens is where the younger sibling picks it up faster than the older sibling is working and working and working and working, and they're very happy plodding along. And the younger sibling comes along and picks it up right away. And the other one just, well, this is clearly their thing. And to be sensitive to it, like, if you like it, if you're enjoying it as a parent, to keep it. And I could tell you from experience, in the sense of, so I have a bunch of kids playing soccer and basketball in the JCC, and some are better than others at their age bracket, and it is the most tempting thing in the world to take the one who is not performing like the other ones and just look for something else when they are happy as a clam. They have no idea that they're not doing well. So if he gets old and doesn't like, it's one thing, but to, as a parent watching it and you see, oh, and we say it like between, it's not his thing. I've said it because look, he's this, at his age, at the same age that all the other kids were at, he's nowhere near where they are. It's not his thing. I mean, it's not. Is he happy? Does he like playing soccer? Is he aware of the fact that it's not? So how do you take it away from him? And it sounds like on paper, like sitting around a table, like the most obvious thing, but wait till you have to write out the $135 check to sign him up for the next league. And in your mind, well, he's never, I mean, this is just, it's not his thing. It, but that's not the issue. The issue is,
is he enjoying himself?
But if he's not a functioning part of the team, I mean,
I'm not talking. Okay, even so, in other words, so does he like playing? So what right as a parent to take it away from him if he likes playing? So what I really want to share is I want to break from her book. Anyone here read Outliers from Malcolm Gladwell?
No. Alex did. I can't use him as an example.
So he quotes a story there which, when I came across it, absolutely blew my mind. It's one of the most frightening things that I had ever read. And he didn't mean it to be that way, I don't think. But he opens in the beginning of the book with a story about the Canadian Hockey League. Fascinating insight.
The older kids.
Fascinating insights. For those who haven't seen it yet, so somebody noticed, in Canada, hockey, one of you is Canadian, right? So hockey is life, or hockey is, and like everything else is sort of just on the side. So they have all these leagues from kids from the age that they're, they begin to walk, they're playing in leagues, all the way up until they get to the junior leagues. So somebody noticed in the mid-90s that the rosters of the top teams in the top division of the top junior hockey leagues were heavily weighted to where the kids who were playing, the 17, 18, 19-year-olds, were born in January, February, and March. It was 40% of the kids were born in January, February, March. 30% more were in April, May, and June. So that 70% of the kids were in the top 4 or 5 months, and then 20% in the last 3 months, and 10% in October, November, December. When you would think, make absolutely no reason for that. Why should it be stacked 40, 30, 20, 10 going down the year? It should be totally even all across the calendar. So somebody figured out, brilliant insight, that the cutoff for the league starting at ages 3 and 4, who plays with what age? So the cutoff, they had a cutoff, January 1st. If you're from January 1st through December 31st, you are 3. And then you're 4 if you were born January 1st to December 31st of the next year, and you were 5. So on and so forth. So in all the 3-year-old leagues, who were the best kids in the 3-year-old leagues? The kids who were born in January, February, March, because they were, at that age, bigger and more developed. When you have 6-7 months over a kid born in October or November, at that age, 6-7 months make a difference. Mm-hmm. So the best kids from the 3-year-old league were chosen for the all-star teams, and the best kids from the 4-year-old and 5, and so on and so forth, where they were then given more practice, better training, better facilities, and they felt that they were better, because they were at that age, because they were bigger and more skilled, more just coordinated. So that it went all the way up to at the point where it wouldn't matter anymore. 18-year-olds, it doesn't matter how many months you had. It's all the same. But they had been given so much extra attention because they were so clearly identified as better early that it actually made an impact. Mm-hmm. And this frightened me to no end. Just frightened me. Because I was watching my kids in school and on the fields and seeing this kid was born in, the cutoff here is September. This kid was born September 5th. Look at him tower over the kids in his class. He is 11 months older than some of the kids in his class. Mm. 11 months of mental, cognitive development, physical development. And this kid was born in May. So this kid is at the back end. This kid's in the front end. And I'm watching this play itself out on certain realms. And then I see the kids in the fields, and I can tell, I'm going to have to go to a couple soccer games right away, who the players are and who the players aren't. And it is so unfair that the players that aren't weren't given a fair chance. They're younger, smaller, and the kids right away pick up that they're not as good as everybody else. They know that. So when it comes to the next season, they don't want to play. Why don't they want to play? Because they're playing with bigger kids who are a little bit older at an age when it makes a difference. And they're turned off totally unfairly. And so we then as parents have to watch these roles in terms of playing the sport, playing the piano, in terms of whether or not, you know, they're interested or not, when it's totally unfair. In I've read a bunch of books. I think he talks about it in Outlier. The Outliers, there's a book, there's a wonderful book called Talent is Overrated. If you like the Outliers, get this book, Talent is Overrated. Fantastic book, in which it's a very similar premise that there is no, the author Jeff something, it'll come to me, argues that there is no such thing as talent. No such thing as inherent talent. And what he argues is that there's a starting point in which some kids pick up things quicker than others, but that to be good in anything, talent makes no difference. And that anybody who's achieved anything in life, and it goes all the way from chess to tennis to mathematics to memory, is only because of the amount of time and effort and practice that you put into it. It goes through study after study. It's very similar to Outliers in that premise of what makes somebody great. And he goes through Tiger Woods, who was playing golf at an intense level from the time he was 4, to all the chess players, to Jerry Wright, like all the greats, where everyone would say, talent. Chess is as classical. You can't, either you got it or you don't got it. That's not true. So to take these kids, as we see them in our homes, on the field, in school, and this one didn't pick up math right away, this one did, this one didn't. And it is so tempting to say, well, this one's good at math, and this one's not. And so you push the other one into some other field, be it the arts, be it whatever, and you take, and you work, and it's not fair to them to, at an early age, have pegged them just because they showed a slight, you know, they were adept at it in some slight manner more than somebody else, that charts their course in life. Because anybody else could catch up, and if anybody else likes it. So we have this very fine line of a balance as parents of noticing the things, encouraging those who are good at it to stay with it, to continue practicing, and then not to allow the fact that this one is good at it and likes it to affect the others who are not as good. And it's obvious, they're not naturally as good. But if they like it, and if they enjoy it, to allow them the same opportunity to deal with it and be involved in it as anybody else, even though they're not as good at it. And if you haven't already experienced it, how easy it is to do that. To see which kids right away pick up certain things, and right away to sort of, you know, block them in, peg them in, set them down that path, when it's not fair to them. Just in the sense that they might enjoy playing piano. They don't care that they're slow or they're bad until somebody points it out to them. And then it's a matter of dealing with it when the older sibling says, I'm so much better than you. That's a whole different story in terms of handling that. But to be aware of the fact that it's so easy to put them into roles. And in life, we will have roles, but we'll have a lot of roles. And it's all about experiencing different types of roles. And the worst thing that we can do is, you know, get a kid into thinking as a young child that this is what they're going to be. This is what they're always going to be. I wonder, I don't have any stats for this. I don't think she spoke about it in the book at all. I wonder, everyone's, you come across people who they're in medical school, and you know, just some conversation, when did you decide you wanted to become a doctor? And I'm like, I always knew I wanted to be a doctor. Like sometimes you hear, like not that way, but a lot of times you'll hear that. I always knew I wanted to be a doctor. I don't have any study, any anecdotal evidence at all. I'm just curious how much of that was guided by, you know, a parent or someone along the way who said something, maybe totally innocently, along the way of, you'll be a very good doctor. Maybe they did something, they showed an interest, and then it just became part of, and you know what, they might wake up 18, 19, like, I don't really want to be a doctor. But it's like too late. Well, 18, 19 is not too late, but it might be 26, 27, they're just like, this is what I needed to do. I was told that I was supposed to do this. So I just wonder how much of that is true. I don't have any reason to them yes or no. Some people might actually always really want to be doctors, and that's fine. But we as parents have the responsibility just to be sensitive to that in terms of pegging them, seeing what they're good at, what they're not good at, encouraging those who are good at it to continue, and also allowing those who are not to do it as well. Because, you know, none of them are going to be gymnasts on the U.S. Olympic team anyway. So this one's a little bit better than that one. So this one likes to do it, you know, gave them, hey, let them do what they enjoy doing, as long as they like it. We mentioned birth order. Birth order is an amazing thing, how it impacts, you know, a family. because the oldest just has more experience doing things and are usually therefore better at it because they practiced more at whatever it is that's going on. And if they're not, they then assume that means they're no good at it, because how could it be that I've been around doing this longer and my younger sibling comes along and does it better than me? You know, we as parents, sometimes you'll see, like, we introduce our children as, this is my oldest, this is my youngest, this is the baby. Mm-hmm. Animals don't even use their names. They're just, that's who they are. The oldest, the youngest, and the baby, or the middle and the baby, in terms of, you know, in my house, I debate this. We always, you know, Shabbos, Friday night, by the brachas, so we always go in order. And, you know, that's, you know, there's a place for that. And I always just wonder in terms of what, you know, how and when, I don't have an answer to that, how and when to keep things in order, oldest first down the line versus it doesn't make a difference. I don't know, but it's something to just be sensitive to as far as how we introduce them and how we see them in those roles. One of the comments that Faber Maslisch mentioned is that we sometimes identify with the kids in roles based on our experiences. Meaning, let's say you were an older sister, and so you had a younger brother who used to pester you to no end when you were growing up. So now you're a mother, and you have an older girl, and then a younger brother. You will identify, as soon as something happens, where the younger brother cheppers the older sibling, with your own life experience of how annoying it was to be an older sister, identify and see what happened as younger brother driving older sister crazy. Even though dad, looking at the same scene, who was a younger brother himself, and views things through the prism of older siblings are constantly pestering younger brothers, which is why they act out in response. And you'll respond to the whatever's going on based on our own life experiences in terms of how we will peg and address the roles that they're in. From that. Okay, Lamaisa. So what does this mean as far as we handle ourselves in the house? So just a couple of points as we go through. So number one, just a comment that I've experienced. As children get older, it's very tempting to use a child to do a parent's job. Let's say if there are three kids in the house, the two younger ones are fighting. So you'll send the oldest child to break up the fight of the two younger ones. Very tempting. And it's very bad. Because you're establishing the role that the older child does. That's not their role. You know, we could use older children to babysit if they're willing, as I spoke about last night. But to start asking of them to do things that is a parent's role is very unfair to everybody. The younger siblings don't appreciate it. I can tell you that firsthand. They don't appreciate it one bit. And then the older sibling starts playing this, develops this very funny relationship with the younger siblings of, I am a secondary mother to you. And I can yell at you if you're not getting into the bath fast enough. And what's scary is that you'll hear yourself in the way that the older children speak. They will mimic exactly the way that you say things, an exact tone. But it's really not healthy for anybody that an older sibling is playing that role just because it's more convenient for us to deal with, and we're valid in dealing what we're dealing with, but to be careful. Shabbos afternoon, I find this the most difficult, where you're trying to host a table, and you have guests at the table, and you know one of the kids will come complaining about something else, and you'll send them back with the message to tell the other kids. It's really a lot more convenient than getting up and doing it yourself. But very often the message is not one that the receiving kids want to hear, but you just placed one of the kids in the role of being the bearer of harsh information, bad information, whatever it may be, and it's tempting, and it's easy to do that, and it's very, to just be sensitive not to use one to play that role, because we establish them. That becomes the role that they play, and so they might really like it and revel in that. And when that happens, it will end up eventually getting larger than the little suggestion that you had for them, and they'll begin to play that role of the policeman of the house. Okay, how do we free the children to change? How do we get them out of the roles that they might themselves have put themselves into? So the first thing to be aware of, and this is just something in general in all parenting, we've spoken about this in every single aspect of the different workshops is just describe. Try not to put our own definitions, our own feelings, just describe what you feel. In the sense of, if you have one kid who's doing very well at something, just not by comparison, don't mention the other siblings. That you're playing so... however we're using the comparing or the putting into roles, just to describe what it is that they're doing is the best way to compliment. I see you've learned that piece so nicely. I see you're playing so well at basketball. So that there's nothing, the connotation of everybody else is not as good. We don't define the role. In other words, what I mean to say is there's a difference between saying this one is our accountant versus saying, you know, I see that you enjoy math and that you're very good at it. So that doesn't take it away from somebody else who might also want to enjoy it. I'm not defining him as that now he's got to be the accountant of the family. And so complimenting in terms of descriptive complimenting, just defining what it is that we see is the you know, what we see, what needs to be done, what I like, what I don't like is the key thing.
What if they themselves bring up a different sibling?
Excellent. Give me an example. Like would be...
aren't I much better than, you know, so-and-so?
Excellent, right. Kids do that all the time because kids want to compare. They want to put themselves
in
that.
And so-and-so can't do it as good as I can because I'm older.
Excellent. So it should become totally common in all of our houses that the phrase, I'm not interested in anyone other than you, is a natural response. It is said in my home weekly to several children.
Harsh?
No, it's a matter of... I'm only interested in you. Yes, you did that very nicely. But where they hear from you regularly... In other words, it's the same thing as I say... I like to bring as an example. It's like a great sermon from by an elevator. You'll always see the sign that says, in case of fire, right, don't take elevator, take stairs. So if there ever were to be a fire, there isn't anybody who's going to read that. But why is it helpful?
Because you read it before there's
because
a fire.
Because every single time you take an elevator and you're sitting there with nothing to do and just waiting, you see it. So it becomes part of every person who ever uses an elevator's basic knowledge that in case of an elevator, in case of a fire, you're not taking the elevator. You're looking for the stairs. Same thing with when you get on an airplane, they go through the whole safety routine. Mm. Like, how many times do we have to go through this? Well, it's because it's now part of our consciousness. That if, chas v'shalom, something would happen, we know what to do. We might panic, but we've been through it 1,000 times. So even that, it's just a matter of, you're going to hear from me regularly. I'm only interested in hearing about you. You did, and then describe what they did very nicely so that it just becomes something which they're familiar with hearing. I'm not interested in hearing your accomplishments as they relate to somebody else. Because it's going to happen in school. You know, it's that same thing when a kid comes home and says, like, I got a 74. So you say, what happened? Everybody got the 70s. Right? So in the same way that I'm not interested there, I'm not interested in you're doing better than everybody else. It's just a matter of I want to inculcate within every child that we're going to measure them based on themselves. And those are the opportunities. In other words, every kid will start comparing. They do that naturally because they view themselves as better than somebody else. They want to say, I'm the best. How do I stack up? And we then train them. That's our job. We're going to measure you against yourself, and so you will. I appreciate like significant learning opportunity when a child says something like that.
is that not though exactly the opposite of how the rest of the world works in terms of business,
yeah,
society?
And that's, yeah, and that's why the world is a really wacky place to be in.
I just said to David that I went through 3 years of graduate school. Will my sole grade?
Right. I was going to say. The system in the school is horrific. And even from a, just when you step back logically, why in the world should it be that my score is only valid as it relates to the particular group of students this particular year taking this particular test? It's absurd that should be my only mark. A friend of mine just took the LSATs, so they had to take it on Sunday because couldn't take it on Shabbos. So they told me that their grade is is marked on a curve, but only from the students that took it on that particular Sunday. So they're not even put in the same pool as the students who took it on Shabbos the day before. The self-selected group of Jewish and Seventh-day Adventist students who couldn't take it on Saturday and take it on Sunday, you're only measured against them. So I'm in the department trying to figure out which student to take. So I get two LSAT scores. It's like almost irrelevant. I don't understand what I'm supposed to make of it. This one was as they measured against that student. And the world does work that way, and that's why we have a lot of unhappy people in life, because they view themselves as only as they relate to somebody else. So if my worth comes from how I compare to somebody else, I will A, constantly be comparing myself to others, and B, constantly trying to push somebody else down, because that's how I get up. And it's a very un-Jewish idea that my value is only in comparison to somebody else. And so it is, you will hear that from the kids all the time, because that is the society that we live in. And it's hard, even in the best of schools, where I don't even know how much effort everyone's putting in, but even in the best of schools, to avoid, kids are going to be kids. Kids will compare. They will constantly try to figure out who's the best ball player, who's the best in math. They will. And therefore it is...
Doesn't that mean we shouldn't be keeping score in sports?
In terms of when they play games?
Yeah.
So you can make an argument. In other words, what's the advantage? In other words, there's...
It's the same thing, right?
Well, it's not really the same thing in the sense of...
This group of
you don't
want to
get rid of competition.
But that is what it's doing. I mean, that is what competition is.
So there's a place, and I totally hope...
Competition is...
Yeah, there's
a
place for competition.
...today than you are.
Right, 100%. I believe there's a place for competition. I don't mean to say that there is no place for competition, and I'm happy that you bring that up.
But competition is nothing but me comparing myself... To you.
In a certain skill, though, but as people...
So is LSAT. It's a certain skill of reading and writing about law, right? I mean, that is a competition, too.
So except that you're not measured in terms of how much you knew.
Right.
You're measured how much you knew in relation to the student sitting next to you.
But no, it's the same thing in playing chess. It's not how good a chess player I am. It's how good a chess player I am compared to you.
100%. So I just want to make that distinction first. In other words, if I have a test... So I'm measuring how much information did you get.
Right.
So I can measure that objectively and give you your score. So now you're giving me an objective score as to how I did. When you measure my score, and I don't, even though I scored X amount, but my score is actually weighted based on what you got, now you're no longer measuring my knowledge of the information, you're measuring it only as it relates to you. So that's what I'm saying, I don't see any role,
score change,
any place
but,
for that. Now, sports is different. Competition is... You, again, unless it's like golf, in which you're playing against the course, but even then it's how well did you do against the course compared to how well he did against the course. In sports, there is definitely, that is for sure true.
But
that's for sure
the
true.
The reason that the law schools do that is they want to take the people who are the top 10%. So that the grading on the curve just allows them to do that more easily.
Right. I understand.
So you're saying law schools shouldn't take the top 10%?
I don't know if they should or they shouldn't. I'm saying when they, the fact that it's measured against, in other words, why couldn't they take the top 10% if you had a standard score and you took the top 10% of that score?
What's the difference?
Because
one, the LSAT is doing the math for the law school. The other way, the law school has to do the math themselves. I mean, it's the same thing.
Right. So that's what it is. It's exactly that in the sense of if I'm a law for that purpose, if I'm a law school and I want a certain level of competence,
right.
Anyone who crosses this score shows that level of competence.
But they really, since they don't have room, they just want the top
10%. That's what I'm saying. In other words, and so therefore, I'm not being graded as to whether or not I'm competent. I'm only being graded if I am as competent as them. So that even though I might have qualified. In my inherent ability, I score low because I was born in a year where there were 10 geniuses.
Right.
That is a funny system. Now, I understand why the law school is doing it because they don't have the patience for that. But I'm saying as far as measuring who I am, I come back and I say, I really studied hard, and I get a low score. So I don't understand what happened.
You're not in the top 10%.
Right, because I happen to be with a bunch of kids who happen to have been exceptionally bright that year. But I'm no longer, so my score doesn't measure who I am. It measures only who I am against a totally variable measure of people out there. So I understand why the law schools do that. I'm just saying, but as far as in the world of trying to build up a child and find out who they are, where it's not inherent to them, it's now based on where they're only good if they're better than the kid sitting next to them or they're bad if they were sitting next to someone, is a very different thing in terms of letting them become who they are. The law school is doing it because, for their purposes, it's easier for
them. The rest of the life is kind of like that. I mean, I agree with the child. The child needs to find their own way, but there is a certain point, though, where they're gonna face that.
And they will. And I'm a big fan of sports. Kids playing sports, and sports is exactly that. It is only competition, and it is only me against you. And I think there's a lot of room for that because life is like that, and learning to deal with that competition. I am all for that. I'm happy that we're happy to define where do we use that? In what realm of life are we using this to define that? So we might find a room in which this child is doing better. He always wins at chess, and that's very nice. The question is where we then identify a child and put them in a role because of how they stacked up. And it then manifests itself in the sense of a six-year-old who doesn't play soccer, even though they were happy as a clam playing, because they don't really stack up. So there's no reason, there's no need for that as far as them getting the experiences in life that they want, especially in relation to the fact that the more that they work on it, the better they will actually become. So in as much as sports, there's a role for that competition that helps us define that, but in terms of how we identify the kids, describing what they are, and in the sense of where this originally got started from, the sense of, you know, I did better than my sibling or my sister, so-and-so, is not interested in how somebody else did. I want to know how you did. Does that answer your question?
I think there's a place for it, and there's a time for it, and it's hopefully not when they're 6 years old or 8 years old.
Right.
Well, at the very least, you would hope that your parents, I mean, the whole of the world judges you, but you would hope that at least your parent will accept you how you are, irrespective of anything.
You want them to be the best they can be.
Right.
Correct.
So in the sense like this,
even if the world will measure.
In a world that will do that, I need to know that my home base sees me for who I am, allow me to become who I am, so that I can deal with the failures in the world that I will live in that says, you're not in the top 10%. And therefore, I don't want you in my law school.
Right.
And they honestly aren't. Even though they had a great knowledge inherently, objectively against the measurement. But the bottom line is, yes, there are kids that are better than you. We don't want you in our program.
Right.
So I want my child to have grown up in the environment where they were treated amongst them. Because what happens is as follows. It's a great example. Take two children. One who grew up in a home in which it was constant comparison, who gets rejected from law school 20 years later, and one who grew up in a home in which they were measured against themselves, who gets rejected from law school, which child will bounce back and say, all right, I'll be a doctor?
One of them is okay with it.
Right. So the world we live in is harsh, and the ability to have them measure themselves and say, yes, I failed, to be able to say, I didn't do it. I really
and
worked
that's
hard.
Okay.
Right. I really worked hard to get into the top 10%, and I didn't do it. And now my choice is to go to a top 15% law school or to go to business school. But I am okay.
Right.
And I think that really is where that comes from.
That
you're
trying to set up.
And I can only stress, as I believe my kids are the oldest in this room, it is really hard as they get older, where we just see them naturally moving towards certain directions, and to then peg that one there, this one here, and to give each one the opportunity to do what they need to do and to say. I can tell you regularly, I don't think a week goes by where at least twice a week, you won't hear the phrase of, I'm not interested in anybody else. I just want to know how you're doing. Kids are naturally that way. Yeah.
So we have a child who's born in August, the latter part of August 21st.
Right. So the baby in the class.
Yeah. And the decision's going to be made probably pretty early on to either hold him back or keep him with his class.
I'm a huge fan of holding back, personally. This is my personal, I'm not speaking as an expert. I'm just, from watching what his experience will be like being the oldest in his class versus what it's like being the youngest in his class. Now, it's just one of many factors. Which kids are in his class, friends, where they live.
I think there's one other issue, and I agree with you. But the other issue is, and I've seen this, you have a child that is understimulated.
Right.
And so it's a fact.
That could be even worse.
100%.
Because then the kid's just going to rebel and is just not
bored out of his mind. It's
right.
It's a factor. You need to figure out
absolutely.
From your yeah. There's a kid that's bored in school, acts out. They have nothing to do. They get bored because they're so. It's a tough position to
exhibit A. It was just awful.
So it's those are the factors, and I'm not going to, I mean, you have to sit down and go over your kid and say, a kid who's excelling at the young age, and some kids are more mentally, cognitively, and physically developed than others, so if he, even though he's a December, an August baby, but if he's there, then you can feel comfortable moving ahead. But if he's on the slow end of his development for where he is, and you say, I'm going to make him the youngest, then you say, like, I don't know that that's fair.
No.
He's literally 11 months younger than the kid in his class who's going to be running circles around him when it comes to the kindergarten. Writing, yeah, reading, sports. And then he lives his whole life like feeling horrible. Now, that's only if he'll be that way. Some kids do very fine. I have one of my kids who's on the top of his class in terms of his cognitive ability is one of the youngest in his class. So there aren't rules like that. But right, even in hockey in Canada, you still have 10% of the kids who are born in December. It still happens, but it's just the numbers are like that. You have to know your kid. You know, speak to the preschool teachers and the kindergarten teachers, and you know, make that decision. Those are tough decisions. Just a couple more things, and we'll. One of the things that we can do as parents are redefine roles for kids. When we hear them saying things like that, like I did better than so-and-so, you can correct them. When kids say, I'm mean, and kids will do that in terms of like one kid's pestering the other. Or we have to watch ourselves. We have to redefine in the sense of where one kid's bullying another kid. So instead of saying the words, you're being a bully, which is what we want to say, or you're being mean, or you are so mean, to give them the words of, you are nicer than that. Or words like, I expect behavior that reflects who you are. In the sense where we define how they view themselves. It's a very subtle tool, but you'd be amazed how kids... it is.
I can see your wheels are just like turning
sweaty. But you use words in which you tell kids... that they're being, you know, this is just an example to hammer the point home. Moradina Friedman, the kindergarten teacher at Terre Haute School, is famous for when kids go on trips. This is what, you know, the parents have picked up on over the years. So the whole bus ride to wherever they're going, she'll be on the microphone saying the whole time, we're going to have such a great time. We're going to have the best time. This is going to be an amazing trip. Right? And then the whole time that they're there, she's saying to the kids, this is amazing. This is fantastic. We are having a great time. Then the whole bus ride on the way back, that was fabulous. We had a great time. So the kids come home from school. The parents say, how was your day? It was fabulous. We had a great time.
She rewatches them.
Right? Because you've given them... Now, it's just like a funny kid, but it when you think about it, in much more important things in terms of how kids see themselves, we will define how the children will see themselves. And when we use words like... you're the aggressive one, you're the lazy one, you're the late one, you're the slow one, we put that into their minds. When we say things, even though they're acting the total opposite, and we say things like, you're so much kinder than that, I'm so surprised that you did that. So the first time, nothing's going to happen. But when we give them an image of themselves, we allow them to see themselves, a younger sibling, we allow them to see themselves not as a victim of the older sibling's aggression. Or if it's the opposite, where we allow the older sibling not to see themselves as a victim. Say, you know, when that happens, you should say, please leave me alone. You don't need to come whining to me. You could say that. And we give them the tools, the words that we want them to say to their older or younger sibling. Or we put things, I expect you to start acting like the nice child that I know that you are.
Flashcards to learn.
Right. That's what we're doing. Right? We're giving them an image.
You know, knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah. Excuse me. Hang on.
Yeah. How am I gonna
build up my kid in this situation?
So none of this comes natural. But what happens is the next time
you'll
100%. The next time that it happens, you'll catch yourself and you'll say, oh, I see what just happened. I just allowed myself when this happened to use the words of you're being a bully, and I don't want to use those words anymore. I want to use the words that I switch that in the sense of I expect you to be able to behave nicer or sweeter than that. I know that you're sweeter than that, and I expect you to start acting that way. So not in a mean, condescending way as a parent, just totally matter of fact.
Those are expectations that are safe.
Yeah, it is. I expect you to be. I remember hearing from Dr. Aaron Feldman once in a class that he'd given. He used the same idea in a different way for a parent who's like banging, a child who's banging down the door to get your attention. You're on the phone and you can't hear the conversation, so you keep moving to other rooms and he follows you. Eventually, you lock yourself in your bedroom and he's pounding down the door. And you finally finish the phone, your conversation, you open up the door, and you say to him, thank you for being so patient. I'm ready to help you now. But like, I'm not really so sure that I was so patient, but the bottom line is, to an extent, like, you had to wait, and now I'm ready for you. And I'm just going to sort of, I need to give you an image of yourself that you see yourself in a role different than what you're seeing yourself in now, which is not easy, but that is our task. One last thing I just want to mention, which again is my own thought. I may have heard somebody talking about something like this. We as parents, as adults, have very different personalities. If you go through a Myers-Briggs battery or anything else, we have very different personalities, which is why we chose the spouses that we chose, because they fit, or they match, or they complement. Some are more outgoing, some are more quiet, or you name it. So children, any family that's going to have more than one child will by definition have more than one personality in the child. So what happens when you have parents, let's just take introvert, extrovert. A classic example, which is a tremendously common intermarriage between an introvert and an extrovert. And they have three children. Two of them are introverts and one's an extrovert. Totally normal, right? Well, I'm the parent who's the introvert, and I have one child who's an introvert and two children who are extroverts. Just forgetting about parent-child relationship, in any situation in life, what personality type will I naturally just cling to?
The introvert.
That's because that's what I'm like. Now, I might have chosen as a spouse an extrovert, because when it comes to choosing spouses, we often do things like that, because we feel like it complements us, and they fill us in a way that we don't find elsewhere. But generally, the friends of an introvert are introverted, because they like doing similar things, like hanging out, doing quiet things together. And extroverts generally find extroverted friends because they like doing things together. It is something to be aware of in a family. If an introvert, and I'm just using this as an example, but it applies to all personality types. If an introvert and extrovert marry each other and they have three children, one extrovert and two introverts, it will be natural that the introverted parent will be inclined toward the introverted child, because it just fits, like in friends. And you say, oh, they're your children. You have to love them all the same. And you do. But you just like might hanging out with one more than the others, because you're like that with everybody in life. You just click with that personality type more. And it's something that is almost frightening as a parent when you discover that. Like, I think I like one of my children more than the other. You don't like them more than the others. You're a person, and you have personality traits, and they have personality traits. And you might naturally click with one more than the other, because especially if one of the children has a personality type that you are never friendly with, that type. And because Hashem has a sense of humor, He blessed you with a child that has that type of personality. You don't have a single friend like that. You will not be naturally as close to that, because that personality type just rubs you the wrong way. It just does. And now you have a child like that. And that's going to be your challenge in life to address that. But it's something that I have found almost relieving to hear, that will be your first natural reaction will be, and it's not that you love that child more, you'll do the same for all your children. But you click. When you're out running an errand with that child, you just have better conversations than you do with that child. And it's just because that's how it goes. And this applies more as it gets older, but it's a fascinating insight. I'm sure I heard this from somebody, in the sense of, it's almost frightening the first time you come across that, but that's life. And then it's a matter of dealing with the fact that that's how it goes. And even though you love them all the same, and you spend time with them the same, but that's a reality of family life. And to be sensitive, you'll often come across families where they say, oh yeah, that child, everybody's, that's mom's favorite. Always has been, always will be. It can be done in a way that becomes very harmful to the other children, and it can be done in a way where it's not as harmful or painful to everybody else involved, even though it's a reality that you just click more with different personality types. But that's something to be sensitive to as we deal with this whole issue of dealing with different kids and their roles and their comparisons and how we handle them and how we give them a fair shot at doing everything, and we don't peg them into certain things, and we allow them to be who they want to be and express who they want to be as they grow up in our homes.
Isn't it rather shocking for a child who has grown with this self, this sense of self that he has that you're describing, to come, the first time he comes across the competition and sees himself fail in compared to someone else. Isn't that
they deal with that every step of the way in life?
Yeah,
every step of the way is competition. You don't have to worry about it. You have to give them
the foundation of your good.
You know.
And so, as a matter of this environment, I, as a parent, will see you for who you are, and you don't have to worry about being compared to another sibling, which is the worst, or people outside the home.
And then you'll like competition.
I totally agree with you. Kids thrive in competition, in sport. It brings out that as long as they don't see themselves as having to be good in order, like I, as a person, am not exactly what you said. I'm not on the line.
Right.
For how I compete, I don't mind the spelling bee. I'm not afraid of coming home in fourth place in my class spelling bee.
Right, there's still disappointment. There's still
and life is
it's not shocking. Right. It doesn't destroy your self-image.
Right.
I mean, I remember competing. I still love to compete. If I lost, and I did a lot, I lost. If I won, that was great. The agony of defeat was not nearly as intense as the joy of victory.
Right.
It was, okay, what's next? What's for dinner?
As a coach... And for my kids playing ball now, the JCC, I'm sometimes tempted to make sure that we lose because I see the coach on the other side, and I don't want those kids going home, you know, if they lost. So like, I'm afraid for them.
No, let them have it.
So, but that's like a horrible, you know, like where there's that pressure and the competition, you know, like so. There's no place for that in our homes, but they will compete all day long. And they need to know that from us, that's not what's going to define who they are, and it won't peg them as to what they can be, whatever they want to be. And they work hard enough, they can be that.
I have another question. I don't know. I don't know. I may have grown up in a very dissimilar environment from everyone who's here, but I had a natural taste for doing exactly the opposite of what my sister did. When I grow up, I'm not going to be. So that because my older sister was like
how much older
is that she was 9 years older than me. I mean, is that
I'm saying that's where this comes from, that the kids want to define themselves. That's what I'm talking about. Sometimes we put them in roles and they put themselves in roles because they want to become who they want to become. But it's not fair for us as parents to allow a child not to be a gymnast just because her sister was. Like, maybe you like, you know, if you decide you don't want to do it. I'm not going to force you to do it because your sister did. But just because they did, then we have to give them the opportunity to, even though it's so natural to do exactly, and for parents to allow that to happen without a second thought. When they might be very talented or whatever it is, and they might have enjoyed it. So if they decide, now you can't force them, but you give them the chance. Just be sensitive to how we often do that and then how that lasts for a lifetime.
Do you find that schools label children?
Yeah, for sure.
They're the worst.
Because they get dealing with 300...
kids from a family are like, you know, all the kids from this family are like this or from...
It's very...
Like if 100%. Your oldest child is a particular way, they're going to expect all of your children to be
I can
way,
tell you, and now at this stage where I've now gone through parent-teacher conferences and I'm now having a fourth child... with the same teachers, it is impossible to avoid them referencing older siblings.
Wow.
Impossible. And they'll say it in the nicest way, because the older child did great, they'll say, it's just like, So it's the most natural thing for them. So we do it also as parents. How did this one do in... third grade. How this one doing second grade in kindergarten.
Even when they're little.
When do they start walking?
Yeah,
right.
Like he has walking,
teeth all over.
Yeah.
It's very natural, and in some ways, it's part of life. And I'm not saying you can't live, but to be aware and sensitive.
Insulate your kid from it.
Right.
It's only natural. We're going to say this one started walking in 13 months. This one started walking at 11. But that's between us. We don't want to label them and say you're.
Right, going to be slow.
Yeah,
or you started. This one started talking sooner than the other, so this one must be smarter.
Right.
Maybe not.
So what about like extended family, who
just keep the kids away from them? Yeah, no, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, my mother's the seventh of six boys in front of her. Seven boys in front of her, and
she's the eighth child.
She was the spoiled
round. I think the opposite, where the boys got all the attention and she was sort of...
Really?
Yeah. So we had a girl first, Leia, and then two boys. And I think to protect my daughter, she was always, my mother tries to, you know,
shower her oldest
with attention. You know, you have to give her, you know, I get pep talks about how you have to give her attention and she needs it and, you know, you want to build her up. I know what it feels like to be, you know,
right, that's what I was talking about, how we take our experiences and we project them onto the kids. And
she might not, how much of that is real.
You watch her. You know, if she might not sense, get that sense at all, your daughter. I'm saying we, as parents, that's just a great example we were mentioning in terms of we take our own experiences and we just project them onto the experiences that our children are having, when they may not be having them at all.
Right.
I have not seen many firstborn girls who are, don't get attention.
Right.
That's generally not been my experience in life, where you need to worry about not giving her enough attention.
Yeah.
It might happen.
Middle child.
But like, it just a firstborn girl is usually pretty demanding of attention. I mean, the ones that I've come across in like all families, that's just, they're good at that. No, she might
her
be an exception.
Her on the other hand, you know.
She might be an exception. This one, you know, you hope you have clothes for in the morning. Yeah.
So speaking of attention, how do you ensure that your children get adequate amount of attention, because they compare.
Right. They will never.
That middle child needs more, but the older one demands more, and like nobody really is paying attention to the baby. The baby's just crawling around because the other two are.
Zone coverage is my answer.
Yeah. So it is. It is zone coverage. But in a serious way, you.
Play zones.
It's a matter of, that's what we talked about last night in terms of as per need as opposed to for being equal. Like give up on measuring.
Well, it's impossible to measure because the circumstances are so different.
Right.
Like, it's impossible to give that baby anywhere as much attention as you ever gave the first one, or even the second one.
And don't tell her.
Well, and the theory is that that is made up now with siblings and other experiences.
It is. But and you will find that you cannot give them the same attention. That's the reality.
Right.
But
how do you keep the resentment?
So I don't, you know, like I haven't experienced that sense of resentment in the sense of if you, as they get a little bit older, their bedtimes get stacked. So that actually creates different windows of time in the sense of like bedtime routines are first this one and then that one and that. Those kinds of things happen. And it's simply just a matter of, and there's no magic formula, paying attention to.
And not comparing one to the
other. You know, it's giving, you know, if you're not worried about that I'm giving each one the same, but that you are spending time with each one, as I'm sure you are, I don't think you'll find that resentment. They play with each other in a way that the oldest one didn't have a playmate with.
Right.
They learn to play with each other. They learn to play by themselves. And I don't have a magic answer. I really don't. But
so much fun.
If you're not adding.
You always hear about the middle child or children syndrome. I mean, if there is no basis for it, then what?
There is a basis for it. The basis for it is very naturally, you'll find, you're three now, right? So you'll find the oldest one is the first to accomplish things, graduate kindergarten and first grade, and the first is working on the math problems, and the baby's just always delicious.
Right.
And so the middle doesn't have either one of those two advantages. So I think the fact that we've made such a big deal about the middle child in popular culture and psychology has made us aware of avoiding the temptation not to go to the middle child's kindergarten graduation because it's just kindergarten graduation. Well, you did it for the first. That's where we fall into that trap, where we actually allow those things to happen, where, you know, drop dead, everyone's going to be at the kindergarten party for the first one. Mm-hmm. And they've got all the pictures to prove it, and the cake, and the presents. And then the middle one comes in a year or two later, and like, where is everybody? So that's where the middle child syndrome comes in. But avoiding those things, and I don't know how to give you you give each one as they need, and I haven't found the resentment unless it's where that sense of that comparison. You'll hear this one will complain about that, and you know a lot of the ability.
They started doing that, yeah.
No, I'm afraid of that. Mm-hmm. So you know.
First of all, don't be afraid of it.
I mean, cognizant of it, I guess.
But I mean that in a sense of, as a parent with a family, we can't be everything for everyone. What I'm saying is obvious, and you know it. But I'm saying it's important to hear. We can't. I cannot give a kind heart. I have six children. I cannot do what I want to do for all of them. But I know that they all feel loved, and they all feel like a part of the family, and they don't, and as much as they might think it'd be better to, I don't even think they think that, even though I'm not giving them what I would ideally like to. And as soon as you have number two, that already is true now for number one.
Exactly.
And when number three is true for the first, for all of them. And releasing the even being worried about it will, you'll see, go a long way in the sense of, I know I can't, and I'm not worried about that. I am going to be the loving, caring mother, and you'll see you'll give to all of them. And you're probably projecting more fear and concern than they have.
I think so. I mean, at this point, certainly.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Hope it was helpful, and you'll give me some good case studies when you send me some emails over the next couple of days and weeks over stuff that goes on.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
So with the arrival of the baby in my special case or whatever particular case, I feel like maybe I should make the older one feel more special, right? So whenever she's eating Cheerios, she says, what about him? And I say, oh no, he's too little. You're big. You can do that, right? So
right.
Now a lot of things, so there is comparison happening, but for some reason it didn't seem like it was in the type of comparison that shouldn't be happening. I don't know. You
so
tell me.
So Faber Maslach would use this as an example. They would say not to be
no,
you don't need to build up the little one by saying he's not a baby like that baby.
Right, that's exactly what I'm doing.
That's what they would have that example. You would get in the book, they use it as an example in terms of the perils of comparisons where it starts really little, in which instead of saying, you're such a big girl, you eat Cheerios already, and I don't need to mention anyone else to point out how old you are, that you know how to use a spoon all by yourself. I don't need to mention somebody else who doesn't know how to do that to point out what she can do. That's the, just describing where you are. And it's not because what happens when 3 weeks later the baby grows and
can eat Cheerios.
So now you have to find something else to build them up.
That she can do that he can.
And what happens is you start on a pattern when it's really little and innocuous, and then it suddenly becomes where it... The younger one is now hearing you're saying the things that she can't or he can't do because the little one. So it's just a pattern of getting into the habit of, I will find ways to praise you and acknowledge you and recognize who you for who you are for who you are without having to mention anyone else.
And I was doing it intentionally.
So I'm saying, I know in their, if Faber Maslach would say, even they are ready to start without saying, I don't need to compare about, I don't need to compare to the baby.
So I read, you know, commentaries, something like, you know, to say while you are, you know, with the baby, to say, and the big kid is near, to say to the baby something like, you're so lucky to have big sister blah to help you to do this, to grab that. But you're saying that's also bad? Because obviously the baby doesn't understand,
I don't know if that's so terrible.
Right, but you want that older child.
Well, you're saying that for the
idea. For the older child to hear that the baby's
so lucky that the big sister can be helpful. No, there the message is big sister is helpful.
when the little sister
starts
is old
growing.
Enough,
yeah,
you've got to also say to the big sister, you're so lucky to have such a great little sister. Because
it becomes a habit to
exactly.
And whenever I give these classes, it's sometimes like I speak in like this idyllic, perfect world where we say everything, and it's not that way. Like you know that already from life, but it's just a matter of like the ideas of being sensitive. And believe if you'd come to my house, you would be able to point out lots of things. Like I thought you weren't supposed to say that. that's life. But
it's bath time. Yeah.
Right?
Rules out the window.
Right? But the overall sense is one in which the rules are a guidepost in terms of how I want things to go, where they get that sense. And if, you know, okay, there's going to be a comparison thrown in here or there, like, you know, we're not perfect. And life presents itself with those kinds of situations. But that's a habit where you don't want to get into because you don't want to continuously need to build up the big one with she needs to feel big because she's not a baby.
Mm-hmm.
She needs to feel big because she's big.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming out. You know how to reach me if you do. I'm happy to continue developing.
When will I know? I have a tumor. When will I know?